The following is a questions and answers session given by His Grace Sriman Sankarshan Dasadhikari, recorded on June 6th, 2009, in Govinda Valley, Australia.
So, the first question is chanting very necessary? Well, it depends what you want. Not really necessary. If you're content to abide in the cycle of birth and death, no, it's not necessary. If you like to regain your eternal spiritual identity, and you happen to be living in the age of Kali, it is joined in the Brihad Naradiya Parama. Haranama, Haranama, Haranama Kevalam, Kurlo Nasteva, 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 Nitya, Nita. In this age of Kali, if you want to become self-realized, you must chant, you must chant, you must chant. So in this age, you want self-realization.
Yes.
Absolutely necessary. Second question. How do you balance karma and dharma? Karma is given up. You merge or dovetail karma with dharma and transform it into karma yoga. Your tendency to act in a certain way, just like I have a songwriting tendency, so I offer that in the service of Krishna by writing Krishna conscious songs. So that's an example. Whatever tendency you have to act in the material world, you offer that to Krishna, so in that way karma becomes dharma. Even though person Krishna consciousness, why is he getting angry and fine? You know, why does Krishna get angry, or why does a Krishna conscious person get angry?
Yes, the second one.
Why
does Krishna conscious person get angry?
Yes. Someone who is actually Krishna conscious never gets angry over his personal sense gratification. He only gets angry when the Lord is blasphemed or the Lord's devotees are being blasphemed. Because he's completely detached from sense gratification, he never becomes angry about his own personal, you know, sense gratification being restricted, like an ordinary materialist. But when he does get angry, it's in the service of the Lord for the sake of protecting the Lord and the Lord's devotees from blasphemy. And that's not in any way selfish or egoistic. That's purely in the mood of service. So sometimes we see that the Lord's devotees get angry not for their personal sake, but for the sake of protecting the Lord and the Lord's devotees from blasphemy. Now, a neophyte devotee might get angry because he's still not completely free of his material tendencies. Sometimes neophyte devotees get angry and fight with each other, you know, they argue about this. So that's not their Krishna consciousness, that's their lack of Krishna consciousness. But someone who is purely Krishna conscious, he never gets angry over any personal, never. He has no agenda for his own sense gratification. I just want to see that Krishna is always served. How can we get motivated from the material life to spiritual life? If you were falling over the edge of a cliff, what would motivate you to grab onto a branch? The fear of death. The knowledge that if you don't grab that branch, you're finished. You're going to be smashed on the rocks below, down in the canyon. So why would you be motivated to grab another branch? It's a matter of survival. So someone who actually realizes that if I don't take to Krishna consciousness, I'm going back down, I'm kind of stuck here in the wheel of samsara, and I can go all the way down to the animal kingdom even lower to the plant kingdom, I can devolve. So I've evolved all the way to this human form, now I should continue evolving. It doesn't make sense to evolve this far and then go the opposite direction, which is what most people are doing now. They evolve, not through Darwinian evolution, but Vedic evolution is birth after birth. Each time you leave your body, you go to a higher form, all the way from the fish, the plants, the trees, the birds, the beasts, the insects. You come up through this whole evolutionary cycle, and you get to the human body, and now, what is the next step in evolution? The next step is to achieve your spiritual body, you see. So to come this far and then go the opposite direction is just a crying shame. It's wasting a golden opportunity that you earned after millions of births. See, that's why it's the greatest tragedy of the human society is engaged in wanton sense gratification nowadays. Because human beings, they don't realize it took them millions of lifetimes to achieve this form from the animal and plant kingdoms. And now they're going to go back. It's a shame. It really is a shame. There's so many scratches in this. Why God created, and it says, be all entities.
Yeah, it's actually, we wrote it.
Show me what I'm answering.
It's this one.
Oh, okay. This one down here. Oh, okay. That was your scratch pad. This is the edited version. Okay. Why God created living entities in the first instance, but and is also destroying them. Okay. The first thing is, God doesn't have to create anyone because He is Atmanam. He can just be there all alone and be enjoyed in existence. But because He is the supreme enjoyer, to expand His own enjoyment, He's emanating countless living beings from Himself. This does not happen in a point in time. It's not that they did not exist and He created them out of Himself at one point in time. No. Krishna is eternally emanating countless numbers of living beings from Himself for the purpose of expanding his own loving relationships. God is eternal, you are also eternal. There was never a time when you didn't exist. He is eternally emanating you from Himself for the sake of having a particular type of loving relationship that only you can give Him. Just like there's no two snowflakes that are the same, there are no two living entities that are the same. So every single living entity He is creating has a certain qualities, characteristics, personality traits that are unique to that particular individual. That person can give Krishna a certain type of love that nobody else can. So you have a particular type of love that you can give Krishna that nobody else can give. There's no substitute for you. That's why, so he's eternally emanating you from Himself to enjoy a particular type of taste that nobody can give Him except for you. And actually, it may appear that God is destroying, but simply the bodies are being destroyed to death. The actual living entity, the spirit soul, does never die. He's immortal. Of all living entities, no one actually dies, ever. Death is simply the material body, it's not the actual soul. And the third question is, how do you meditate with body and soul? Well, it's very simple. Yat karoshi yadasnasi yadjahosi tadasya. You engage your body in everything you can in Krishna's service. You bow down before the Lord, you engage your body in coming to retreats like this one, or going to the temple, or doing service, offering food. You engage all of your activities, mental, vocal, and bodily, in the service of the Lord. And that is, the devotees here in Sydney will come show you and teach you. Now, of course, when I'm here, I'll tell you, but the more you get association and training, you can learn how to turn your house into an ashram. Just like we have an ashram atmosphere here, you can make your own home into an ashram. Where just by going home, coming home from work, whatever, you walk into your house and you say you're in the spiritual world. And you can turn your house into an ashram. And just by doing your own housekeeping work, then you're doing devotional service because you're, enhancing the ashram. So, and then you can invite devotees over to do a kirtan in your home. And this way, and the whole atmosphere becomes sanctified. And, this way you can gradually influence your friends. But first of all, you just become fixed yourself. That's the main thing. In the beginning, it's very hard to convince, to attract our friends, because they just think we're nuts. First of all, you become completely convinced by reading these books, by engaging in these practices of bhakti yoga, and actually experience. In other words, go beyond the theoretical platform. You get to the point where you actually taste it. You actually feel it. You actually live. You feel how you're living. You feel how you've actually entered into the transcendental dimension. You see, that will happen. If you seriously practice this on a daily basis, you will feel how you're actually living in the transcendental dimension beyond time and space. It won't be some, blind phrase. It'll be something you scientifically taste, experience firsthand. So, next question. Thank you for your nice question. Okay. Why just Krishna? Why not other gods? God means controller. And there are many controllers. Even in your office, your boss is also a god. You know that office, you see. There are many, many gods. Your prime minister is the god of Australia, you see. There are many, many gods. So we don't say that there's not other gods. But there is one supreme god. God means, God with a capital G means the Supreme Being. There can't be many Supreme Beings, that's absurd. If I say there's many Supreme Beings, then I'm actually espousing atheism. I'm saying there is no Supreme Being. How many Supreme Courts do you have in Australia? When was the last, let us count. How many Supreme Courts? How many? One. Because that's the meaning of Supreme Court. One without a second. You can't have, there's no country that has more than one Supreme Court. Because it's not the Supreme Court that there's more than one. So you can have many gods, that's all right, but one Supreme God over all the gods, Deva Deva. There can only be one Supreme God. So Krishna declares that he is that Supreme God, Arjuna declares that he is that Supreme God. Now that Supreme Krishna, he has many names, he has many, he exists in many forms and expansions also. Balaram, Sankarshan, Narayan, Vasudev, Prajumna, Aniruddha, many different forms and expansions of them. Chaturvyuha, the Shiradakarsha Vishnu, Garbhadakarsha Vishnu, many different forms and expansions are there of that Supreme Person. They are all the Supreme Person. It's called Vishnu Tattva category. They're actually unlimited Vishnu Tattvas, but the demigods are not Vishnu Tattva category. But, you know, Indra, Ganesh, Surya, all these are Jiva Tattvas like us. It is more powerful Jiva Tattva. They are living within this material existence, presiding over different planets within the material world. But Krishna and his multifarious expansions, they are ruling over the spiritual world, you see. Krishna and the topmost planet, Krishna Loka, is Vishnu expansions and all the Vaikuntha planets. Number two, what if at the end of life we realize that there's no Krishna? Well, what did you lose? I remember I was one time told when I was preaching at the University of Florida, everything is an illusion. And I was thinking, what if Krishna consciousness was an illusion? I was wondering. But then I realized that even if it's an illusion, it's the best illusion. But another angle of Vishnu, if everything is an illusion, then the philosophy that everything is an illusion is also an illusion. It cancels itself out, so you don't have to worry about that. So if you found there was no Krishna at the end, well, at least I had, you know, if Krishna is an imagination, it's, the, like I said, the best illusion I ever found. Then everything's an illusion, really. Yeah. Even if everything was real and Krishna was an illusion, this is, I've tried at everything, okay? Back in the 60s, we tried everything. And I can tell you, this is better than anything else. If you want to stay high forever and keep getting higher and higher, you see. You want to enjoy like anything 24 hours a day. There's nothing, even if Krishna is an illusion, this is better than anything, everything, anything else in the material world has to offer. That's the thing. So you could say, well, it's a gamble. My goodness. What if he actually is an illusion? I spend all this time chanting, you know, offering prayers to somebody who's just an illusion. Are you afraid maybe you're gambling your life away? You know, you might be cheated at the end. Well, look at the odds, you see. Look at it this way. Take it as a gamble, you see. If Krishna is real, what do you get? You get an eternal life full of bliss and knowledge. And if he's not real, the whole thing was just a, you know, Prabhupada made up this whole illusion, you know, and hoodwinked us into becoming devotees, you see. Even if the whole, what did you lose? I mean, I'm having a great time. I don't know about you. I'm in bliss. I've been never this happy in my whole life. So even if the whole thing is just a, you know, Prabhupada just duped us, you know, this he took this Hindu myth, I'm going to go to America and fool all those people, you know. I'm going to take this Hindu mythology and tell them that it's real. There really is a Krishna. But if you study the Bhagavad Gita, that means the Bhagavad Gita is also untrue. Why is it? Because the Bhagavad Gita directly states that Krishna is reality, you see. Parangdhama, parangdhama, parittam, purusham, bhavan. Arjuna is directly saying, you're the supreme truth, you see. So that means the Bhagavad Gita is a fabrication. Which they do claim. But actually it's read and accepted by great scholars throughout the history of the world. You know, the great American philosophers read it. It's accepted. I mean, all I can say is I know in my search for truth, nothing made sense until I found the Bhagavad Gita. And the real reality is that you will, if you follow this process, you'll meet Krishna face to face. And you'll know that Krishna is real because you'll actually meet him and become his personal associate. So if you're doubtful, just stay on the pathway and I guarantee you, you'll come to that point where you personally come face to face, eye to eye with Krishna. Okay, and then you'll know it's not, you'll know for sure it's real. Until then, you have to have some faith in the great soul, all the great Mahajans throughout the history. Svayambhur Nandana Shambhu Kumara Kapilo Mino Manu Falado Janako Bhishma Balir Vayasakirbhyam. All the great Mahajanas of Vedic culture, they've all accepted Krishna as the Supreme. So if we're being duped, it's a pretty well organized, you know, illusion. All the great Acharyas have confirmed this. And so, and plus, if you saw Prabhupada, you could realize this person would never cheat me. He would never cheat me. We've never seen such love in any person in our life that we got from Prabhupada. We knew Prabhupada would not cheat us. We knew that. We had never met such a saintly, amazing person in our lives. So full of love, you know, it was unbelievable. So, if you have any shadow of a doubt, just become a pure devotee, and then you'll know when you meet Krishna personally. Why are we sure that the scriptures are not man-made? Okay. Well, the scriptures directly say that Krishna says, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Bhagavad Gita especially. How do we know it's not a man-made concoction, as the scholars say? How do we know? What's the proof? Well, these scriptures themselves state they are divine, they are coming from Krishna. In other words, these scriptures are themselves historical evidence. How do they establish any history? You see, you take documents, and they base on those documents they establish the truth of some ancient history. How many of you have seen Mahatma Gandhi? You've seen him with your own eyes. Anyone? How do you know he existed? Well, it's documented. They're very, very documented. There was a person named Gandhi. So Krishna is also documented. If we accept Gandhi, why we wouldn't accept Krishna? They're both documented. Why one document would be considered legitimate, another would not be considered legitimate? They're all documented historically. How do we know George Washington was there? In the U.S., you know, the founder of the U.S., first president who fought those Britishers, got independence, you know. How do we know that George Washington is not a myth? Well, there's documented evidence. People made paintings of what he looked like. You know, we have things that he wrote. We can see where he lived. There's so many, the same thing for Krishna. So we accept George Washington. Why we don't accept Krishna? The same sort of evidence that establishes George Washington also establishes Krishna. So that's fine. Number four. What is the purpose in dancing before Krishna? That Lord Chaitanya taught us. This is the method of developing love of God. Chanting, dancing, and feasting. Sing and dance and take prasad. Lord Chaitanya showed us this is the way to purify your heart and become transcendentally situated beyond birth and death. Okay, next question. All right. Thank you very much. You have been chanting for the last 38 years. What's the difference between you thought from the day one? Oh, my God. Wow. It's the difference between what I experience now and what I experienced in 1971 is absolutely phenomenal. I never dreamed that I would be like this. But I never dreamed I'd be. If you saw me, Sankarshan Das Brahmachari, you know, back in 1971, you wouldn't think I was the same person. I'll be honest. There's some early photographs of me. You wouldn't think I was the same person. I've been so much metamorphosized, if that's the word, by this process. And it just keeps on happening more and more. The transformation in my consciousness is phenomenal. I'm amazed by what I've gone through in the last 38 years. And the further I get along the road, the faster the change happens and the sweeter it happens. In other words, the evolution of consciousness simply increases. It speeds up. The more you evolve, the faster you evolve. So it's incredibly exciting. That's all I can say. In the early days, I couldn't even imagine, you know, fasting half a day was like being dragged to the pits of hell or something. You know? But now I can relish near Jalakadasi and go, this is great, and you give my digestive system a rest. So just little things like that. I can dive much deeper into the holy name. I was just on the surface. I feel I'm going very deep into the holy name now where I didn't feel that before. What motivated you to join ISKCON? Well, I'll be honest with you, as a songwriter, I was thinking, as a countercultural songwriter, we had a desire to revolutionize this planet, you know, turn history upside down. That was our goal back in the 60s. And I realized I didn't have the potency to do that, but I saw the Prabhupada did. That was one of the main motivating factors. I wanted to turn the world upside down. I was sick and tired of this crazy mess going on all around me. I wanted to see a spiritual revolution happen during my lifetime. And I saw the Prabhupada as the one who knew how to pull it off, not me. Because even my own heart wasn't revolutionized, you see. How I can revolutionize the world if my heart isn't revolutionized? So I realized Prabhupada was the one, so I'm just going to help Prabhupada. I'll help him do it. That was my main motivation. And the desire to become self-realized. Because both things are happening simultaneously. There are sincere religious people in other religious religions also who are meat-eaters or who don't follow the regulations. Regulated principles, what chances are there to recognize or to regain or to something their spiritual life? R-E-C-O-G-R-E-N. What is this word? For them to something to be.
What chances do they stand of making any spiritual progress?
Yeah. The essence we can understand. One can progress in other pathways, but as long as you're engaged in activities of animal eating flesh, as I explained earlier today, as long as you have a taste for eating meat, you're not qualified in the spiritual world because there, no one eats meat. If I think that I require the blood and flesh in my mouth to feel happy and satisfied, I won't be able to go back to the spiritual world. Now, I could progress to the point of giving it up and realizing. There are Christians who do that. They realize that this meat eating is wrong. This isn't very Christian. There are Christians who say this is not a Christian thing to do. A true Christian, or even Muslims who say this. There are Muslim vegetarians too. So one can progress, but as long as one is engaged in these activities of meat eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling, you're lighting a fire that you're pouring water on at the same time. It's counteracting. They can make some progress, but they keep nullifying their progress by sinful activities. If they would, they can remain a Christian. They can remain a Muslim, a Hindu, a Jew, whatever they may be. If they will give up their sinful activities and chant the holy names of God, then they will become perfect. They don't have to convert. They don't have to join the Hare Krishna movement. They can remain a Christian, a Hindu, a Jew, or whatever. Buddhist, Muslim, you know, anything. Any bona fide religious system coming from a great saint in the past, they can follow that pathway. They have to give up this meat-eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling. And then they can make progress. They don't have to join our movement. But they have to take the principles of pure bhakti and apply them within their own tradition. That's a thing. What if a devotee cannot think of Krishna at the time of death? Well, if that devotee has dedicated his whole life in Krishna's service, and if by chance he doesn't remember Krishna at the time of death, Krishna will be very kind, and Krishna will appear in his consciousness at the last moment out of kindness. If one simply gives his whole life for this mission, and somehow or other, you know, he gets distracted at the final second, Krishna will mercifully jump in and supply that devotee with his darshan, his remembrance, or his remembrance of the time of death. So just give your whole life for this mission and you'll make it. Special question from Anand. How can I please Krishna so that I can get a lot of toys? Yes. Very good. How would you like to have unlimited toys? I will tell you how you can have unlimited. How the whole world becomes your playground. I will tell you a secret, I believe it. Krishna owns everything. And if you give yourself to Krishna, you fully, and then he will give you the whole world as your toy. You can have the whole world as your toy. Everything in the whole world becomes your toy. You just have to fully give yourself to Krishna and you will have unlimited toys. Millions of toys. You'll have more toys than any boy in the world. More toys. Just give yourself completely to Krishna and he'll give you unlimited toys. Okay? Out of the four regulated principles, where Krishna has explicitly mentioned not to have illicit sex. And where does Krishna mention? These injunctions are there in the Vedic principles, are there in the Vedic scriptures. They're definitely mentioned how these things are sinful in different writings of the great acharyas. So there is no doubt that this is sastric. Just like I have found in the Manu Smriti, there is a verse saying that onions and garlic are not eatable. They're not suitable for eating. Many people say, oh, why no onions and garlic? It's right there in the Manu Smriti. Onions and garlic are unsuitable for eating. So there are scriptural verses for all of these rules and regulations if you do the research in the Vedas. Those can be found. If I need the garlic verses there, there's verses about all of them. To substantiate, all of these can be substantiated in the scriptures. I don't know the references offhand, but they can be substantiated. And we take our substantiation from Srila Prabhupada. Because a self-realized soul, he's as good, his words are as good as the Vedic wisdom. If Prabhupada says they are improper, we understand they are improper because we have our faith not only in the words of Krishna but in the great self-realized devotees like Srila Prabhupada. We understand that he has perfect realization of all the Vedic wisdom. So because Prabhupada has told us that they are sinful, we know they're sinful. And it also makes, it's very practical. When can you see and experience how these things distract one and they bring them back to the bodily platform? Which is really common sense. That these things are bad for one's Krishna consciousness. He says that sex according to religious principles is mean. And so that means that sex which is not according to religious principles is not mean. According to religious principles means sarvadan samskara. In the Vedic system, there are different purificatory ceremonies. There's the birth ceremony, there are different samskaras. And so when you get married, there's also a samskara. And then after marriage, there's another samskara. When you want to make your wife pregnant, you don't just have sex when you get lusty. No, that's not how it's done. You have a public festival. You invite the Brahmins, you distribute charity to the Brahmins, you have prasad distribution. It's called Garbhadan Samskara. It's a ceremony that now my wife and I are going to try to have a baby, and now we're going to get the blessings of the Brahmin. Just like in the spring, the farmers will have some ritual before they plant the seeds in the soil. It's a similar thing. I'm going to plant the seed in my wife. It's a public ceremony. Now I will plant the seed in my wife to try to have a child, so we will have a ceremony. Garbhadan Samskara. Baba didn't institute that, but he did institute our ISKCONized version of that, which is chant 50 rounds of japa before having sex. On the most fertile day of the month, according to the ladies' menstrual cycle. So you try to make her pregnant at least once in a month on the most fertile day, and that's the system that Prabhupada gave us. Not that I just, whenever I get lusty, I'm going to have some recreation. You know. It's sex is for procreation, not for recreation. That is the Vedic system. That could be a whole long hour lecture. I don't want to get into it now. We get too much ground to cover. Explaining why that principle is there, why it's important, what the pitfalls are. You know, there's unlimited things I could say about it. Sometimes we have a whole lecture on that, but there's no time tonight. What is the purpose of offering prasadam when Krishna doesn't actually eat? Who said Krishna doesn't actually eat? Krishna does eat. I dropped it for dramatic effect. Krishna does eat. How we can say Krishna doesn't eat? Krishna does eat. Just because you can't see that he eats, that doesn't mean he doesn't eat. Krishna does eat. He takes that food, he consumes it, and he puts it back. He takes that material energy, he eats it by hearing your prayer of love. He eats it through his ear, and he puts it back there. As prasadam, pure spiritual energy. Krishna does eat it. That's a fact. You can't say he doesn't eat. Not true, he doesn't eat. He does eat. Does this back also? No, this is just a scratch. Okay, now begin. Where's another seat?
Coming?
Whether he eats or not, he wants you to offer it to him. So that's a good point. Okay. How can we
prove that there is a God?
Prove there is one?
That there is a God.
That there is a God. Okay. This is a very easy thing. Do you have any experience that something comes out of nothing? Show me. Tell me. What comes out of nothing?
Of like personal experience?
Yes. Give me an example of something that comes out of nothing.
Coming to ISKCON was something coming out of nothing. No one took me there. I didn't hear from
some object. Let's say this microphone stand. Tell me an example of some object, some material thing that just manifests from nowhere. It's like when you ever make popcorn before? Who's made popcorn here? Okay. Can you just take your an empty pot and put it in the stove and go, okay, let's get some popcorn. No, you have to put some kernels in, and the popcorn pops out of the kernel. You see. Now, can you make popcorn if there's no kernels? No. The popcorn pops out of the kernel. So, show me something that exists that popped out of nowhere. Anything that popped out of nowhere. Anything. Any building, any country, maybe, you know, maybe New Zealand popped out of nowhere. I don't know. Give me an example of something that popped out of nowhere. Anything popped out of nowhere? Everything has an origin. Everything has an origin, right? Okay. So, and that thing also had an origin. And the what caused did had an origin, and that it had an origin. You go back. And finally you come to a thing that has no origin in medicine. Or, for another example, you have a father, right?
Yes.
He has a father? Yes? You think so? No, he has a father. He has a father, his father has a father, the father, the father, the father, the father, the father, the father. You go back, and you come to a father who doesn't have a father, that's God. So God must have been. Another example is, every machine has an operator. You ever seen a car that just drive itself? It'll turn on its own ignition. Every machine, even if you program it to turn on, like the lawn sprinkler, you know, you can program it to turn itself on, you know, every 3 days. But you had to program it to do that. Every machine has an operator. In this world, you'll find that every, it's like my watch here, itself, I have to go like this, after a while it will stop working. Depends on my moving my hand, you see, to wind it, a self-winder. So everything requires an operator. So if every machine within our experience requires an operator, isn't it logical to understand that the supreme cosmic machine also requires an operator? Would it be logical or scientific to say that every machine has an operator, but this one doesn't? That's not scientific. If every machine has an operator, then this cosmic machine must also have an operator. So that's pure logic. Who created Krishna? Well, Krishna created Krishna. Obviously. He's self-manifested by his own desire to exist. If somebody created him, whoever created him would be God. Because Krishna is God. Therefore, Krishna is eternally creating himself in his own desire to exist. That's who created Krishna. Krishna creates Krishna at every second. And he creates us also by his desire to be. Why is he supreme? Because everything emanates from him. He's the source of all existence. Why did he create us? Because he wanted to expand his own loving relationships. Why deity worship? Because right now, we are so impure, we cannot see how God is present before us, even though he is present. We can't see him, our eyes are covered. So he appears in a form which is visible to us, in the form of the deity, so we can learn how to meditate on his form and how to serve him, so that we become qualified to enter his spiritual world. What is the right time for Krishna consciousness? Right now. Right now. You should surrender right now. Fully surrender to Krishna right now. Don't postpone it for 5 minutes. Now's the right time. Why can't we eat meat? Well, would you eat your little brother? If you're a little stupid, you know, mentally retarded? Well, he's mentally retarded. He crawls on four. He's still crawling around in his hands and legs. He's mentally retarded. He doesn't even walk on two legs. You know, so, you know, just eat him. You know, what's the point? Maintaining a little brother that's mentally retarded, you know, just eat the guy, you know. Did you do that? So why do you want to eat your brother? Your mentally retarded brother, the cats, the dog. See here. Well, actually, in China, they say, yeah, let's eat the cats and dogs. You know. They have you go to here you go to the pet store to get a dog to take home, you know, to get him a nice dog house, you know. You take him to the pet store to get all kinds of nice. But in China, you go to the dog store to buy a dog to eat him. I wonder, how much is that little doggy? Why don't you take him home and slaughter him and eat him? That's what they do. You see? So, we find that repulsive. But in China, they think, these people, most people are crazy. They have all those nice, plump-looking dogs in Australia, don't even eat them. They think we're nuts over here in Australia, because we don't eat dogs. So why eating meat is for very low class people, you know, who have no consciousness that they're alive. The animals have feelings too, just like you do. Just like you have pains and pleasures, you have affection for your family members. The animals also have those things. So how you can kill them and eat them? It means you have no human qualities. A meat eater has no human qualities. He's just an animal. He's not even a human being. Meat eaters are not human beings, actually. They don't have human, they haven't awakened their human consciousness yet. Why offer our food only to Krishna? Well, we don't say offer only to Krishna. We say offer it first to Krishna. I need some water. And when you offer to Krishna, then you can offer to the whole world. First, we don't say only to Krishna. We say first to Krishna. Once you offer that food to Krishna, I see a water bottle over there. Then you can offer it to everybody. You want to offer the demigods, you can feed the demigods. You can feed all the people. You can feed your friends, your neighbors, your relatives. You can feed everybody once you feed Krishna. So Krishna first, because Krishna says you should offer to me first. Patram pushpam palam payam bhumi bhakta priyachati tadaham bhaktya bhajatam vishnamita yatatmana. So we should offer food which is yajushishta shanashanta bhuchanta isarvakil bishai. He says that the food should be first offered to me. If, as per Krishna consciousness, all souls are equal, then why certain practices women are not allowed to do as per the Vedic system? Well, women are not biologically equipped to do things that men are, and men are not biologically equipped to do things that women can do. That's a fact. If I wanted to get pregnant, I couldn't do it. I don't have a body to get pregnant. You have a body that can get pregnant. So there are biological differences. You see, if I want to have a child, then I have to make my wife pregnant. My wife can't think, well, I don't want to have a child, I want to make my husband pregnant. It doesn't work. There are natural biological distinctions, and so one has to act in terms, and also women are objects of exploitation in the world. Women have to be worried about being raped. Men don't have to worry so much about being raped. Men are physically stronger than women. So that means men have a duty to protect women from being exploited by unscrupulous men. So the men, they have to do that particular duty of seeing that all the women are saintly men. He has to see that the women are being protected and not being exploited by unscrupulous men. And the women, they have to be chaste to not allow themselves to become exploited by unscrupulous men. So there are certain natural, due to biological, and there are actually even psychological differences that men and women have. Because of our different physical natures, I mean, we have psychologies that go along with our physical natures. I mean, you know, what a woman does with her body, a man doesn't do. So in order to be happy with that situation, one has to have a mentality that goes along with it. So the fact is that there is a not only a physical difference, but also a psychological difference between men and women. Of course, the good news is, when you come to Krishna consciousness, you go beyond all that. But because we're not completely pure devotees yet, we have to purify our psychophysical nature. So in the Vedic culture, there are certain distinctions on, you know, man acts in a certain way, a woman acts in a certain way, to maintain chastity in the society so you don't have unwanted progeny, you know, abortions and all those things. There's a certain division between men and women to keep the society pure. So it's not that Krishna is an equal opportunity employer. It's not that he's down on women or he's down on men. Krishna is up on everybody. He wants to give everybody, and he does, in fact, give everybody an equal opportunity to become a pure devotee. And we're certainly not down on women. Actually, if you study our prayers, you'll see that Every morning, we're praying that we're all praying to become women in our next life. Do you know that? In our morning prayers, we're begging to become women. Do you know that? In our Tulsi prayers, we're begging to become women in our next life. It become gopis in Krishna's pastime. We're actually all praying to become women in the spiritual world in our morning worship. It's in the songbook. You can see the sheets we handed out the morning. And you can read it right there in the sheet we gave you. Now, every morning, all over the ISKCON world, we're all together praying that we can become women in the spiritual world. So actually, a woman is a very glorious position. To be a woman in Krishna's pastime is a very, very glorious position. But as long as we have these male and female bodies in this material world, we act in certain ways for the mutual benefit of each other, you see, to help each other in our Krishna consciousness. I have certain duties in a male body, you have certain duties in a female body, and we execute those duties out of love for each other, you see. I do my male duty as a service to you, you do your female in this way. We do our duties as male and females to help each other as this loving family that we can all become pure as quickly as possible. So how relevant is the Vedic culture in today's time? The Vedic culture is absolutely relevant. The Vedic culture is desperately needed. When this planet was under Vedic culture, which was for millions of years up until just 5,000 years ago, the whole planet was under one ruler based in India, and there was peace and prosperity over the whole planet. I mean, look at all the problems. Why Vedic culture is needed? Look at all the problems. It's like, what is the big anxiety now? Global warming, right? That's one reason we need Vedic culture, because it'll solve the global warming problem. Because as soon as you bring Vedic culture in them, the human society is now living back in harmony with the laws of God. That means all the nature becomes properly adjusted again. You see, now we're being punished because we're living in sin outside of, in a disharmonious relationship with God. So all of the difficulties on the planet, you know, the drought, the Australian drought, which I don't know if it's still going on, but, you know, horrible reports from areas where people were formerly, you know, farming, but now it's just a complete wasteland. What if the whole country became a desert? How would people even live here? You see what I'm saying? So these things are all due to the fact that we abandoned Vedic culture. Vedic culture is absolutely necessary. We have to bring it back for the peace and prosperity of the human society. Who is the first God, Vishnu or Krishna? Actually, Vishnu is a category. There are millions and billions of Vishnus. Krishna is the original Vishnu. Balarama is the second Vishnu. These are all Vishnu categories. Within these Vishnu categories, some of them are called Vishnu, some of them are called Narayan, some are called Nrisimha, like this. These are all Vishnu category, living Vishnu category personalities. Of these Vishnu category personalities, Krishna is the original Vishnu. That's why we're called Vaishnavas. That's why we Krishnites are called Vaishnavas, devotees of Vishnu, because Krishna is the original Vishnu. So who is the first God? Vishnu or Krishna? You could say Vishnu hyphen Krishna, or Krishna hyphen Vishnu, because Krishna is Vishnu, and Vishnu is Krishna. The original form of Vishnu is Krishna. Vishnu is the category. And the original person in that category is Krishna, from whom all the other Vishnus are emanating. When do you go to a spiritual master? Right now. And how do you know we need a spiritual master? I'm telling you, you've got to have one. You've got to have one. Without a spiritual master, you're like a dog without a master. In the Indian street dog. You've seen the street dogs in India? Ooh. I mean, you don't see that in Australia. You know, here they're all pampered, you know. They're dogs with masters. It's horrible in India. Oh my God. Having grown up in the West and going to India for the first time and seeing those street dogs, oh my God. Those poor little creatures, all their hair is from this skin disease. They have no hair. They have wounds all over their body from fights with other dogs. They don't get enough food to eat. They're like little skeletons walking around. They get close. People throw rocks at them. And they're just the most paranoid, horrible little creatures, the dogs without masters. If you go to Juhu Beach, where all the rich Bombayites, you know, walk, the Mumbaiites now, walk their dogs, you know, on Juhu Beach, those dogs are stout and strong and jolly, you know, walking with their master. So, when the dog with master, he is called Sanata, and the dog without master, he is called Ananta. So, how do we know we need a spiritual master? Because without a spiritual master, you're nothing. You're nowhere. You're lost in the cycle of birth and death. You have to have this guru to get you out of the cycle of birth and death. Huh?
Why is God, why is Krishna a menial?
Why
is
Krishna a male?
Huh?
Why is God, why is Krishna a male?
Well, he's not always a male, you know. He has his female form also, Mahinimurti. But why is he primarily a male in his original form? Actually, male means, according to Vedic system, male means enjoyer, and female means enjoyed. That means actually, all of us here, we are all female. God is the supreme enjoyer. Bhoktaram jagatapasam sarvaloka maheshwaram. Male, according to Vedic analysis, means enjoyer. Female means enjoyed. So all of us are female. We are all women here in that sense. I'm female, you're female, we're all female. God means the enjoyer. So therefore he is called male. Plus, in sex life, in the example of sex life, the actual, according to from Vedas, we understand the living force is there in the semen of the man. And he plants that seed in the womb of the wife, and there the seed develops a body. So the original seed is there in the male. So God is the seed-giving father. So in that way he also is met. He's understood as male. Because he is the seed-giving father. And the material nature is the mother. In fact, Krishna's expansion on his Mahavishnu, he impregnates the material nature. Not by his genital, but by his vision. Through his vision, he impregnates the material nature with countless numbers of living entities. So God is male because he is the impregnator. And the material nature is considered female because it is impregnated by God's impregnating power. So in that sense, we understand God as male. And when he came, he demonstrated a male form also. And he could say, well, why not a female? Well, God wanted to. He has a choice. He can be male or female as he likes. Sometimes he does show a female form. But in his original, he chooses by his own desire to be a male in his original form. That's his choice. You say, well, Krishna, why didn't you want to be a woman? Well, I wanted to be a man, that's all. But you know what? Krishna, when he saw Radharani, his topmost devotee, was tasting more nectar as a female than he was as a male, God himself decided to become female, in the mood of a female. Lord Chaitanya is God in the mood of a female, in the mood of servant of the Supreme. Even though he had a male body, his mood is female. Female means servant, wanting to serve. It means the servant of the master, that's female. To be the master who accepts the service, that is considered male. So God actually saw that it's more enjoyable to be in the female mood than it is to be in the male mood. So he appears at Lord Chaitanya to taste even more nectar by being in the female mood than he was in the male mood as a business form of Krishna.
It's not like how we live here in the physical world. It's not like an ego that he was talking about before. It's different.
So she's asking, it's not the ego like you're talking about before, and it's different.
As male and female in this world.
So the spiritual world is not...
No, here we are covered by a false sense of identity, male or female. This is false. In the spiritual world, there are actual transcendental male and female forms, which is the actual self. It's not a false ego. But you can actually switch. If one is not happy as a male in the spiritual world, you could switch to being a female. If you're a female and you weren't happy, you could be a male. You can be whatever you want to be in the spiritual world. But actually, to be a female is considered the topmost position in terms of rasa. Because the females, they have the most complete opportunity to experience Krishna in all ways, more than the males do. Because they can have that conjugal rasa with Krishna, whereas the males can't. There's no homosexuality in the spiritual world. It's an aberration of the material existence. They don't have gays in the spiritual world. It's an aberration. Any other questions? No? Right. Okay. As time goes by through four yugas, the dharma gets worse. Why is that? Why not the other way? Well, the material nature, if you haven't noticed it already, has a tendency to degrade, 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 degrade. I've seen it happen in my own life. I remember back in the 50s in the U.S. when sex was dirty and the air was clean. And now, sex is clean and the air is dirty. You understand? Things have degraded. In the old days, back in when I was in high school, if you got a girl pregnant, you would marry her. That was what any gentleman would do. He messed around and had a little entertainment on the weekend and things didn't go as planned. He would marry the girl. But now, women's lib. Go and get an abortion. Kill it. Kill it. Kill it. Things have degraded. They really degraded. Really, the material nature degrades. So, but then when it gets so bad, then Kalki Avatar comes and brings in another Satna Yuga. There's a grand, a clean sweep with his sword wiping out these rakshasas that have just completely overtaken the whole planet. So it's a natural thing. The material nature gets degraded by its very nature. It's the nature of the material nature. Personal question, how you came to Krishna consciousness? How much time do we have? We're limited on time. My supervisor informed me of it.
Everybody needs to wake up from Mangalati.
How many more sheets do we have? Is this the last sheet? This is the very last sheet? All right, I'll try to do, squeeze it in real short. Well, every single moment of my coming to Krishna consciousness was absolutely memorable. Every single moment of it was absolutely memorable. Basically, I could see that the whole world needed to be revolutionized. And I mentioned this earlier. There, on the one hand, that was my own vision of what the world required. On the other hand, it was my own personal need for enlightenment. Both things were happening simultaneously. I've told this story many times, but just in brief, I had tried so many different gurus and swamis and yogis, and nothing really worked for me to awaken my enlightened consciousness. So I turned to the Bible, and where Christ says, I tried to figure out what made Christ the self-realized soul that he was. And I found that he said, "Father, not my will, but thy will be done." And I understood that was it. You just got to do what God wants. And then you become perfect. You become like Christ. Christ-like personality. It's by doing simply what God wants, forget what you want. But I had one problem. I didn't know what God wanted me to do. I knew that I had to do what God wanted. That was what I needed to do to become spiritually perfect. I didn't know what he wanted me to do. So, I started praying, "Dear God, please guide me." So Vishnu John Maharaj showed up in town after some time of my praying, and he introduced me to this movement. I realized this is what God wanted me to do. So that we don't have so much time. Is this kind of the only way to know Krishna? Right? No. Yes and no. Theoretically, no. But practically, yes. It's the only place you're really going to get what you need to get there, to get there quickly as possible in this one lifetime. I don't see other people who are giving. Prabhupada is unique in giving us the formula, exactly what we need. It can be done elsewhere. If they can take the same thing that Prabhupada is doing, take Prabhupada's guidance and apply it within their own institution, then it can be done elsewhere too. But I don't see anyone doing it. So theoretically, yes, but practically, no. I don't see it outside of this movement right now. There are other Gaudiya Vaishnavas, but they're making offenses against Srila Prabhupada. And that hurts them in their chance to attain Krishna Prem by offending a great Vaishnava. Does the devotional clothing absolutely necessary? No. Prabhupada said you can be Krishna conscious in any dress. But what did he wear? Acharya teaches by his example also. Is there proof of life after death in this country? Life after death. Yeah, all of our devotees, all of those devotees who appear, they're all going back to Goloka Vrindavan. If you want proof, go to Goloka Vrindavan and just see. Some say that we can travel to the spiritual and other planets. Anybody in this country? Of course. All of our devotees who are going back to Gaya, they're all traveling back to the spiritual world. Many of them. We're having a major ISKCON center now in Goloka Vrindavan. So many devotees have transferred to ISKCON Goloka. It's going to be the biggest ISKCON center. You see, it's even bigger than Alachua. And eventually, I don't know if it's there yet, but it's getting there. In one of the verses of the Bhagavad Gita, there is a capital S in the letter Self. Does this mean self, small s, we the people the same as God? No. The self-realization has two meanings, the supreme self and the individual self. Krishna is the supreme self and we are the individual self. There is a distinction. Krishna says, do your duty and leave the results to God. If so, why we have to follow the Parvayudatam's laws? That's your duty. It's your duty to follow these things. And the result you gain, the positive result you gain from doing that, you offer to Krishna. Now I got Krishna Ganya through Prabhupada's books. Why can't I accept Prabhupada as my spiritual master? You must accept Prabhupada as your spiritual master. You must do that. Why do I need another spiritual master? Because Prabhupada said you need another one. Whose question? Yes. Because Prabhupada said you need another one. Yes, you must take him as your guru. It's your guiding principle. So now your guide, Prabhupada, he told us in Vrindavan that after he leaves the planet, the new devotees who get initiated, they'll become disciples of the disciples. So you say, well, I'll take Prabhupada as my guru, but not these. I won't take Siksha or Diksha from one of his disciples. Then you're guilty of half-hand logic. But this part of Prabhupada I like. In this instruction of Prabhupada, I don't like. That means you don't really accept Prabhupada. If you really accept Prabhupada as your spiritual master, then you follow his instruction to become a disciple of one of his disciples. That's his order, that after he departs, the new devotee should become disciples of the disciples. So if you don't do that, you don't really accept Prabhupada. That's a fact. It's just some word juggling, actually. If you really accept him, you'll take his siksha as your life and soul, and you'll find out one of his disciples, and you'll take a diksha from him, Prabhupada's order. And the next one is service to humanity is service to God. Devotional service, which is good. Yeah, they say, Nara Seva is Narayan Seva. Huh? Yeah, they also say Nara Seva is Narayan Seva. Someone wrote me that the other day. Same principle. Serving man is serving God. They say the beggar in the street, he is Narayan, Dharidra Narayan. So if you feed the beggar in the street, you're feeding God. But do you think God is a poor man? That's crazy. God has become a beggar in the streets when Lakshmiji is serving him hand and foot. It's absurd. What is their service to humanity? You know, in America, they give out turkeys on Thanksgiving Day to all the poor people. Oh, I'm doing such a great service. But guess what you're doing? You're sending all those poor people to turkey bodies in the next life, and you're also going to get a gobbler body in your next life. Walking around the turkey yard, gobble, 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 until they gobble you up on Thanksgiving Day also. So what kind of service you're doing by your so-called welfare work? You're sending people to hell in your so-called welfare. If you want to do something good for the people, liberate them from their suffering. Your so-called welfare work is simply increasing their suffering. It gives a temporary sense of relief, but then after that they get increased suffering. So you want to serve humanity, great. Make them Krishna conscious. Then you're doing the real service for humanity. Can we achieve salvation only through chanting without knowledge or reading any books? Actually, chanting has to be pure. Otherwise your chanting will not give you salvation. Chanting, pure chanting means you obey the orders of the spiritual master, and the spiritual master orders you to read these books so you can know what is the science of chanting. When you go to in chemistry class, you go to the lecture and the lab both. If you go to the lab without going to the lecture, you'll have an explosion in the lab. You will know what you're doing. So you have to read the books to understand the process of how to make the chanting perfect. Otherwise you can chant for millions of lifetimes and still remain in the material existence. Dancing on the streets, any significance? Yes, it's Lord Chaitanya's movement. Is ISKCON doing anything for the environment? Yes, we're doing everything for the environment. By every time you chant Hare Krishna, it is the greatest offset. It is called a karmic offset. You see? They say carbon offset. You do your carbon offset. Did you do your carbon offsets today, Johnny? You know, now that's the new thing. Did you eat your spinach, but now did you do your carbon offsets today, Johnny? Everybody must do their carbon offset. But the real offset is you do your karma offset by chanting Hare Krishna. Because this global warming and all these problems is simply the result of contaminated atmosphere. And so if you really want to purify the environment, you have to chant Hare Krishna. In other words, contamination comes from the subtle plane to the gross plane. Because the minds are polluted, therefore the gross plane also becomes polluted. So you can't purify just by trying to clean up the gross plane. It'll never happen. As long as you remain contaminated in the subtle plane, that contamination will transfer to the gross plane. I don't care how many bottles you recycle or whatever you do, you know. It's not going to clear the contamination. If you want to clean the environment, clean the minds, and then it'll be done. Okay, two more questions, and that's it. Krishna has many gopis, girlfriends. How can we take him as a role model? Why do you want to take him as a role model? This is you? This is yours? Why do you want to take him as a role model? Why do you think he has to be a role model? Is his duty to be your role model? You think he has a responsibility to be a role model for you? He's a supreme enjoyer. He doesn't have any obligation to be a role model for you. If you're looking for a role model, he appears as Lord Ram to be a role model. His pastimes of Ram is role model. But for Krishna, he says, no, in Krishna form, I don't do any role model business. I just enjoy, that's it. He has no responsibility of a role model. He has no obligation to be your role model. He's simply the enjoyer, and that's it. Say, but Krishna is doing something illicit. He's enjoying other men's wives. Oh, Krishna. But you know what? You're the rascal. You husbands here, you're the rascal. Because you're claiming those wives as your property. Actually, they all belong to Krishna. All the women belong to Krishna. Every woman in the world belongs to Krishna. Hope I don't offend you. Actually, it's the greatest blessing to find out that you belong to Krishna. We all do. But the point is, Every woman is the property of Krishna. And if you claim, this is my wife, you are the thief. You can't say Krishna is enjoying other men's wives. You are enjoying one of Krishna's women. You rascal, you're the cheater. You're claiming this is my wife. That you're a rascal. She belongs to Krishna, not you. See, there being all the women are abused because the men think this woman is my property. That's why women are abused. But a true Krishna conscious man, he sees the woman as Krishna's property. He simply sees that she's nicely advancing in Krishna consciousness. There's no better husband than a pure devotee husband. There's no better husband. The best husband a woman could ever expect is a pure devotee of Krishna. Because he won't ever exploit her in any way. He sees her as Krishna's property, engages her nicely in Krishna's service. That's it. Okay, the very last question now. How long would it take to become fully Krishna conscious if I start right now? It depends on how serious you are to achieve it. I can tell you right now that you can be Krishna conscious within 1 second. Whose question? Yes. Katvanga Maharaj, if you studied the Bhagavatam, he became Krishna conscious within 1 minute. It can take 1 minute or it can take millions of lifetimes. That's why I say, make your best effort to become fully Krishna conscious right now, because you never know. If you take this pathway of Krishna bhakti, there will be 1 minute at a certain point in time when you will become a pure devotee and you will see Krishna face to face, eye to eye. Now, how soon would you like that to happen? Tonight? Or do you want to wait for a 10 million lifetime? So, why not try to have it happen tonight? Right now. Pray to Krishna, my dear Lord, I'm tired of this envy, this lust, this anger, this greed, this illusion, this madness, which has plagued my consciousness for millions of lifetimes. Please bless me with pure bhakti right now. What is the best prayer for doing that? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare
Hare. We thank you very much. We'll meet again tomorrow morning for Mangal Arti. You have 5 minutes to get in bed now. Turn off the light. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai.